And our sermon text today, the one which will guide our reflections, is Romans 12:18. I'm not necessarily exegeting just this particular text, but it will help guide our thinking. And 12:18 reads, but as it is, no, that's 1 Corinthians. Wrong book, sorry. Romans 12:18. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. And our title today is The Just War Theory on this Memorial Day. Enough of our race has been lost in warfare without without losing any more than we have to. And the church has developed the just war theory to help moderate these things. On May 7, 1915, a German U-boat sunk the British ship Lusitania off the shores of the British Isles, some 1,200 passengers on board, 128 of them American. It became the precipitating reason for the United States to enter World War I. Now, most of America was in favor of the war, infuriated at the German action, and in warm sympathy with England and France. Not everybody. The great American statesman William Jennings Bryan, President Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, thought that war was an extreme overreaction to the provocation. He had his reasons. Bryan was a pacifist who thought that the gospel taught that violent self-defense was only warranted when one was attacked directly. Germany had not done that to the United States. And he thought that the United States had no vital interests in the war between the Allies and the Axis powers. And he also thought that the U.S. was supporting the Allies directly with money and materiel and being deceptive about it. In fact, in 1993, an expedition to explore the wreckage of the Lusitania discovered tons of ammunition and weapons in her hold, despite protests to the contrary by the British. And just as the Germans had warned, they would fire upon ships suspected of bringing in war supplies to the Allies under the cover of civilian transport. And that's exactly what the Lusitania was doing. So in good conscience, Bryan resigned as Secretary of State in June of that year, seeing that Wilson was determined to go to war. He had only agreed to serve as Secretary of State because Wilson had run on a platform of non-involvement in the war. Wilson was supposedly the peace candidate. So to Bryan's thinking, Wilson had violated that promise. In fact, it can be demonstrated that Bryan, and not Wilson, acted in accord with what we call the principles of the just war theory. What constitutes a just war in the sight of God and man? Is that an oxymoron? A just war? Can war be just? It's an important question for the church to ask today. Is the war we are fighting with Russia justified? Do we have any business sending troops to Ukraine or helping her with any kind of aid, like weapons and money, which we've been doing? The drums of war are being steadily sounded, aren't they? Our emotions are being stirred by stories of atrocities by one side or the other. Justice belongs to the Ukrainians since they were invaded. Others say Russia was deliberately provoked by the United States and NATO. Whence the truth? What criteria can we use to sort out the just cause, if there really is one at all? So don't be lost in the passions of the moment. Many with far greater wisdom than us have wrestled with this question for centuries. In fact, the church has long wrestled with the question of whether it's right and good for the Christian to pick up a weapon at all, or whether a Christian king or magistrate should maintain an army at all. The early church asked these questions too, and many, many more. Consequently, when emperors like Constantine or Justinian asked the bishops of the church, when is it permissible to wage war? The church, after a while, found the sword of the magistrate in its hand rather than at its throat, as it had for so many centuries. So Christian kings asked, when is it permissible to wage war? Under what circumstances does God look with favor on the magistrate when he bears the sword? How should a Christian prince conduct a just war? All of these questions and many, many more came to the forefront, right? When the sword of the state, finally in the hand of the Christian kings instead of at the throat of Christian martyrs. The answer the church gave back to the Christian prince is what has come down to us as the just war theory. The inside flap of your bulletin, you have a brief outline of the seven principles of the just war. It is taught at the United States Military Academies. I had a conversation with my son John, who graduated from West Point. It's still taught there, and in fact, it forms the basis for much of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the good old UCMJ. If any of you have served, you know this is a book by which you are judged. The just war theory. It took centuries to craft. We don't have the time to go into its history today as much as I'd like to, but know that the fathers of the church spent a lot of blood, sweat, and tears literally making it. It was shaped not in the ivory tower of the intellectual, but on the bloody battlefield of the soldier, and in the councils of the courts of kings. And it was given perhaps its finest expression in the work of St. Augustine, in his magisterial work, The City of God. There are seven major principles articulated by the just war theory. Number one, a just war can only be waged after nonviolent options have been exhausted, with the emphasis on exhausted. So often kings are so eager to go to war, aren't they? The Apostle Paul laid down this principle, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. That's a principle richly reflected in all the Bible, not just that one verse. Every Christian prince or magistrate is obliged to pursue this course sincerely. Charlemagne tried to deal peaceably with the Saxons, but when they kept betraying every peaceful arrangement that he established, Charlemagne had no other recourse than to use force. We saw this in our church history course. Can we say that we have exhausted nonviolent options with Russia over its dispute with Ukraine? There's ample evidence that we, the United States, have been interfering in Ukrainian politics for decades now, destabilizing the democratically elected president back in 2014, Yanukovych. We deliberately worked to destabilize his presidency and setting up a puppet president friendly to us, Poroshenko. Biden, in his confession of intimidating a prosecutor in Ukraine, mentions this one, Poroshenko. This was back in 2014. We have also insisted for years that Ukraine join NATO, a direct threat to Russia, tantamount to Canada joining the Soviet Union back in the day. Additionally, we have been secretly training Ukrainian military forces and arming them long before the outbreak of this war. Don't let anybody tell you differently. To say that we have exhausted nonviolent options is disingenuous in the extreme. In fact, it is safer to say that we have encouraged warlike means rather than nonviolent ones. America is in direct violation of the first provision of the just war. A just war can only be waged after nonviolent options have been exhausted. Second principle of the just war. A war is just only if it is waged by a legitimate authority. Both of our texts today dealt with legitimate authorities or illegitimate authority. Justice is not served by actions taken by individuals or groups, like Barabbas. Governments duly constituted are deemed legitimate. This, too, is a long-established biblical principle. Treasonous actions like that of Athaliah in the Old Testament, right, who slaughtered the line of David and Judah, except Joash, in order to establish herself as queen is precisely the kind of thing prohibited by this principle. David refused, as a good example here, David refused as an individual to raise his hand against the Lord's anointed, King Saul, because it was illegitimate. Now, I have covered this principle in history in previous radio broadcasts, too. I refer you to them, specifically my series on Oliver Cromwell or Guy Fawkes, right? Who was legitimate and who was illegitimate there, right? Let me just tease you with that. Was it Oliver Cromwell or Guy Fawkes? Do you know these guys from history? Guy Fawkes was a 17th century terrorist, really, who acted with a few conspirators to blow up Parliament in the gunpowder plot in order to overthrow King James I. Oliver Cromwell, on the other hand, was a member of Parliament who undertook to throw off the tyranny of King Charles I as a legitimate authority. His New Model Army, commissioned by Parliament, defeated the king and established the English Republic. Well, what can we say about the legitimacy of the Biden administration? Evidence is mounting, if you've seen 2,000 Mules, for example, almost daily that the election of 2020 was most likely, not conclusively for many, but most likely for some, most likely fraudulently stolen from President Trump in crucial swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona. And if this can be conclusively demonstrated, then the present administration is not a duly constituted government. As long as we continue to fight this war with illegitimate authority, we cannot say that we are honoring this second principle of the just war theory. A war is just only if it is waged by a legitimate authority. The third principle of a just war. A just war must redress wrongs suffered. Very important principle. One that the church was just constantly berating kings and princes and magistrates all through these past 2,000 years of church history. A just war must redress wrongs suffered. Exasperating, it was a provision included so as to exclude wars of conquest and empire. How often have kings marched off to war in order to add to their lands, increase their sphere of influence and power? Seems to be the history of the kings of the earth, doesn't it? What the church hoped to capture within this sphere of the just war was the remedy for actual wrongs suffered. Actual wrongs suffered by people and nation that undertakes a war. The princes of the Crusades, for example, contrary to the barrage of criticism leveled at them, actually went to the Holy Land to reclaim former Christian lands lost to a predatory Islam, which had been brutalizing Christians there for centuries. The king of the Byzantine Empire had appealed to the West to come and right the wrongs which had been suffered by them at the hands of the Seljuk Turks. The Crusades were just. They were legitimate wars to redress wrongs suffered. We spent 4 weeks in our church history course looking at that. It's another long-established biblical principle, too. For instance, Israel went to war against the Amorites on behalf of the Gibeonites, with whom they had a treaty. The Amorites had wrongfully gone to war against Gibeon, and Israel marched to their defense to redress wrongs suffered by them. What can we say of the present administration's war against Russia? We have no treaty with Ukraine. We have no national interest in fighting this war. We have no business investing American blood and treasure in what is essentially a Slavic civil war. How many times must we become bogged down in fruitless wars, like the 20-year disaster in Afghanistan? And does anyone really trust the commander-in-chief who shamefully withdrew from Afghanistan and left so many Americans behind, billions in military hardware in the hands of a terrorist regime? Can we be confident that he is competent to redress wrongs in Ukraine? I'm afraid that what will happen is that we will only commit new wrongs and compound the evil being done in Ukraine. Certainly, Russia has inflicted suffering upon Ukraine. But we fail to calculate what Ukraine has done to Russia as well with our aid and comfort. With all of the wrongs inflicted on Russia by our own government, she might well be justified in saying that she is fighting a war to redress wrongs suffered as well. Alas, America cannot say she is honoring this third principle of the just war theory. A just war must redress wrongs suffered. Our involvement in this war is not honoring this third principle. We are not redressing wrongs suffered, but rather our government is only creating multiple new evils. Fourthly, a just war must be undertaken with a reasonable chance of success. A just war must be undertaken with a reasonable chance of success. Casualties incurred in a hopeless cause are not morally justifiable. That's a prohibition on the old romantic lost cause of many a rebel. The Bar Kokhba Rebellion, which ran from AD 132 to 136, 4 years in Palestine, in which the Jews rebelled against the Romans one last time, is a case in point. A romantic but lost cause. The Jews had no chance of success, although they wistfully hoped to reprise the Maccabean revolt of their fathers against Hellenist tyranny, that was. And they hoped to free themselves of Roman domination. Instead, Rome decided to fashion their own final solution to the persistent problem of Jewish resistance. And they massacred the population and dispersed the survivors all through Syria and the surrounding region. Hopeless causes. This provision was meant to stem the romantic hopeless cause, which only results in great slaughter. The resistance of Ukraine is folding even as we speak. It has no reasonable chance of success, and that's not to diminish the bravery of the Ukrainians. They are valiantly resisting. But it is a hopeless cause. And our participation has only escalated the conflict to the brink of nuclear war. The current administration and the Republicans who go along with them, who keep sending further billions to Ukraine, are only provoking, arguably, the most heavily armed nuclear power on the planet. Some call for acts of war, like imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, and committing U.S. troops, for that matter, if evidence of chemical or biological weapons have been used. That's sheer recklessness. What reasonable chance of success is there in an all-out nuclear war? Success, nuclear war, that is indeed an oxymoron. But that is where we're headed. Who succeeds in that case? Anyone involved? Can we have said to have succeeded in a just war when our nation is a smoking cinder from an all-out nuclear exchange? The church has no business baptizing this war as a just war when we consider the unreasonableness of its success. Number five, a just war. A just war must have as its goal the increase of peace. The increase of peace. Shalom. The peace established afterwards must be preferable to the peace that would have prevailed had the war not been fought. That was the baseline established by the church as it worked through what constitutes a just war. We're called to live lives of peace. Make it your ambition to live quiet, peaceable lives, minding your own business, working with your hands so that you might win the respect of outsiders and not have to be dependent on anyone. And then, of course, from Romans 12, if possible, so far as it depends on you, that's not always possible, but so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. And it's not a hopeless irony either that a just war can bring peace. The defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo brought an end to the Napoleonic Wars, and it brought peace to the European continent that lasted for a century. And despite the brutal conduct and methods of the Roman army, the peace that ensued, the famous Pax Romana, was greater for generations than the peace that would have prevailed had her wars not been fought. Even church fathers like Augustine made this argument for the continuation of the Roman Empire. And his encouragement for all Christians to pray for the peace of the Roman Empire. The same cannot be said for the current war in Ukraine. Once more, it must be emphasized that we're virtually trying to separate two fierce, scrapping wolverines, if you will. And this happens when we stick our business in the midst of two fierce animals, we get hurt. And conflict is only inflamed and magnified, not lessened. Our involvement in Ukraine only lessens the odds for peace. Can any one of us who are being provoked by the rhetoric of this administration really think that this administration is competent to bring peace to this region of the world? This administration cannot bring peace to America, much less Ukraine. We are interfering in what is essentially a civil war between Slavic peoples that's been going on for centuries, and we have no business getting involved there. England and France wisely stayed out of the blood feud that was our civil war because they saw no advantage to meddling in our American fratricide. There was no upside to taking sides in the American Civil War of the 19th century. We had to settle it ourselves, howsoever bitter and bloody it turned out to be. And it did, didn't it? Huh? The same can be said for our meddling in this Slavic blood feud of the 21st century. We will not increase the chances for peace by getting involved. Our meddling will only aggravate conflict and increase the chances that any peace that ensues will be more fragile and bitter than before it started. So do not listen to the warmongers in the deep state who keep beating the drums of war. There will be no peace following them. You and your children will only pay dearly in American blood and treasure for generations to come. Additionally, the chances of an all-out worldwide nuclear war are vastly increased by our involvement and careless rhetoric of our leaders. And as every responsible military planner knows, no one goes to war without clear objectives. When are we victorious? What does victory look like? What do we want to achieve by this military action? None of those questions have been answered. Sixthly, the sixth principle of a just war. The violence used must be proportional to the injury suffered. This is a tough one, a tough one to enforce. The church has almost thrown up her hands at trying to apply this one and strictly admonish Christian princes. The violence used must be proportional to the injury suffered. War is brutal by its very nature. Once the passions of war, we must keep this in mind, once the passions of war are inflamed, it's almost impossible to control excesses, isn't it? Examples can be multiplied from almost any war. The massacre of Jews by the so-called People's Crusade during the Crusades, we looked at this in our church history course too. Or the rape of Nanking by the Japanese during World War II, or even the massacre at My Lai by Lieutenant Calley and his command in the Vietnam War. Once the so-called dogs of war are unleashed, they must hunt. There's not much we can do about that. But oh, what a price is paid as they wreak their bloody havoc, the dogs of war. The church has tried to maintain a measure of restraint on this tendency. It's not always realized that the Old Testament maxim, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, was actually a biblical restraint on vengeance. A biblical restraint imposed on the followers of the one true God. Many other cultures, like those under the Code of Hammurabi, for example, encode excesses of vengeance by the upper classes and the lower classes. The Bible held for strict application of equal justice, an eye for an eye, not two eyes and a hand, a tooth for a tooth, not a mouthful of teeth and a foot. What can be said for the war in Ukraine? If you've been following the unfolding events, getting you news from more than the mainstream media, then you know that atrocities have been committed by both sides in this conflict. To say that it's all on Russia is propaganda, meant to inflame your righteous indignation. And you have to ask, too, in the background, is nuclear war proportional violence? Not anymore, right? In fact, one of the scholars I read, wrote a book on the Christian responses to war, said with the development of nuclear weapons, the just war theory is out the window, no longer applicable. But certainly nuclear war is not proportional violence. It's the very definition of escalation. By any measure, this war is not a just war by either side. We should not be involved at any level. Seventh principle of a just war. A just war must discriminate between combatants and non-combatants insofar as it is possible to avoid them in attacks on military targets. discrimination between combatant and non-combatant. Civilians have always gotten sucked into the vortex of the deep drain of war, haven't they? Attila the Hun deliberately savaged, raped, and tortured the peoples that he conquered. Islam has always treated any non-Muslim peoples indiscriminately as kafirs, unclean, indistinguishable from soldiers, liable to the sword in every conquest by the armies of Allah. The church, as it worked through this, in its admonishments to the princes of Christendom, attempted to restrain the bloodlust that always accompanies war. Rescue those who are being taken away to death, Proverbs says. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. Exodus tells us, keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. Solomon tells us in Proverbs that one of the seven things that God hates is the hand that sheds innocent blood. It's a principle well established in biblical tradition, and the bishops of the church constantly disciplined princes whose passions drove them to excesses. When, for example, Emperor Theodosius in AD 390 impetuously slaughtered over 7,000 Thessalonians because someone killed his governor, Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, bravely excommunicated him for the murder of innocents. Of all the nerve, Theodosius said. A stubborn Theodosius eventually repented, though. Ambrose stood fast, and eventually Theodosius repented. But it was a long journey to that repentance. It's another one of those rollicking good tales from church history. The American military has a euphemism for this phenomenon, doesn't it? Collateral damage. That sounds so impersonal, doesn't it? Like your glass of water got tipped over. Collateral damage. When a so-called smart bomb aimed to take out a house filled with terrorists also kills innocent bystanders or neighbors, they're tabulated as collateral damage. Now, I'm assured by John, and this is an ironclad principle that is inculcated in officers, we have an official policy of minimizing collateral damage. That's an operative principle in our military. But it's always easier to maintain in the classroom at West Point than it is strictly to adhere to in the fog of war. But it is nevertheless one of those principles most officers and soldiers honor and try to live by. This element of the just war theory is being transgressed certainly by Russian forces as whole cities are being subjected to bombardment and shelling. Reports of civilians regularly being shot, blown up, along with the military of Ukraine. Commonplace in the news, isn't it? There seems to be no effort to distinguish between civilian and soldier. All in all, we must conclude that America's involvement in the Ukraine war is a transgression of almost every point of the just war theory. America is waging an undeclared war, for that matter, an undeclared war, which is producing utterly evil consequences. Do those of us who feel passionate about risking nuclear war know what we face? Albert Einstein, in reflecting on the development of nuclear weapons after World War II, said, I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. That's what's at stake. To those of us who listen to those in Washington, D.C., who have destroyed our economy, sickened our culture, and cynically impose tyranny on us, do you now mean to tell me that they are suddenly righteous patriots who will successfully wage an honorable war. This war and our involvement in it is just another step in our enslavement, in our progress towards tyranny. Alexander Solzhenitsyn says this about war. He says, a state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny. That sums it up concisely, doesn't it? A state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny. Brothers and sisters, let us instead pursue peace and reconciliation between Russia and Ukraine. James assures us a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I love that. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And above all, the United States should have no part in the fighting of this war. Now, many Christian historians have reflected on this, that, well, the just war theory is in many respects a high ideal. That's very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve, right? Nevertheless, it has tempered, and it has relieved suffering in many cases when it's been followed. It is nevertheless a metric by which we can gauge our performance before an all-holy and righteous God. And I think the church, I'm still optimistic enough to think that the church, in crafting this metric, the just war theory, guided by the scriptures, has given us a high ideal by which to live. Pray for peace, then, as we should diligently pray for peace. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Work for understanding as well. And may the peace of Christ be yours. May it be ours in our nation. That's the first and necessary step for peace among mankind. The first peace is peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, inculcating the gospel, spreading the gospel, preaching the gospel, applying the gospel. There will be no peace amongst men unless there is first peace with God. So this first peace we must pursue. Peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, and may that peace be with you this day. Let us now come to that place where we see the peace of God indeed reflected in the simple elements of bread and wine as we participate in the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.